And thanks for joining me, everyone. Charles Moskowitz, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're welcome to call in the program. This is a live program, also podcasted on all the subscribing stations. You can join us by phone by calling 617-396-4958. That number again, 617-396-4958. If you'd like to chat, go to rumble.com/Moskowitz. Oh, sorry about that. And we will read your chat. So you can email me at charlesmoskowitz@gmail.com. I want to thank TECN TV, the Exceptional Conservative Network, Ken McClanton, the owner, for carrying this program. It's a great honor to be a part of that station. My guest this segment is Roger Phelps. He is the author of the book, Not Exactly the CIA, A Revised History of Modern American Disasters. Roger is a career news reporter with an MA in philosophy. Roger, and he's been published in numerous publications. Roger, thanks for joining me today.
Hello, Charles. Good to be here.
So, Roger, you know, the CIA obviously has been in the news a lot lately in terms of what I think President Trump accurately called the deep state, what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. It's been given various names and possible interference in American politics. You get into some very specific events that occurred around the time of the Vietnam War and with an Indian reservation in Arizona where the CIA was conducting experiments. So let's go right to your thesis and talk about what your research revealed.
Would you like to hear more about the Cabazon Indian Reservation connection to this thesis, or would
Yes.
you like me to be more general?
No, let's start with the Cabazon Indians.
All right. Well, that was a private, hyper-private piece of property in that a reservation is not subject to U.S. laws with exceptions for such as, you know, crimes of violence. Then police can enter a reservation, but otherwise it's not subject to U.S. laws. So as it happens, there was a joint powers agreement between the Cabazon tribe and a security agency called Wackenhut, mm-hmm. which is a fairly well-known name in American history.
Yes.
George Wackenhut, I would credit him with being what you might call a member of this loose organization.
Sure.
Not exactly the CIA. He is one example. The agreement was for production of rifles and other weaponry. Rifles were sold on a particular day. I'm going to check the date just for accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
It was September 10th of 1981. And a list of the attendants at the meeting included arms dealers, arms makers, and a couple of CIA agents. It also included a guy named Michael Riconosciuto, who is another fairly well-known name.
Mm-hmm.
He was a CIA asset. And as you know, an asset is someone whose private work coincides accidentally with interests of the CIA, and he can be useful.
Sure.
So Riconosciuto was a science genius who won the Stanford University his Youth Invention Prize with his own argon laser. And the guy running the contest said, you don't forget a 16-year-old who shows up with his own argon laser.
Mm-hmm.
So Riconosciuto is a genius.
Yeah,
and he was the asset run by a guy named Earl W. Bryan, who figures heavily in the book. Brian wound up working for Governor Ronald Reagan in the Reagan gubernatorial cabinet. But these attendees were there because also there were two members of the Contras, the Nicaraguan opposite army.
Right.
And so that was a demonstration at a firing range just outside the Cabazon Reservation. So I thought that was interesting. This is all recorded by the local police, who did not interfere, but they recorded it carefully. So Wackenhut is the one here that takes the story forward.
Okay.
And Reconosciuto, who, while working at his family's arms, or I should say explosives factory in the San Francisco Bay Area, he worked on what is known as a fuel air explosive. Now, these are not too well known because they were used by the Soviets first, and the United States didn't want anybody to know that we didn't have them. But Reconosciuto perfected one while an asset for the CIA.
Right.
And if we jump forward now to the Oklahoma City bombing, if that's okay,
I'll just stop here. Before we go there, I just want to talk a little bit more about the Cabazon tribe situation.
Sure.
You know, I could understand why the CIA might be involved with arming the Contras in their war against the Sandinistas. Mm-hmm. That's something that the CIA does, for better or for worse. It's not necessarily good, and sometimes they're interfering in nation building, and it's not good. But nevertheless, what I don't understand here is why were they involved with an American, Native American tribe giving them major weaponry? That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, that is for sovereignty. That's for secrecy as a product of sovereignty. You see, right. They were untouchable on the reservation, and that's the sole reason. I think that's a sufficient
reason. So then the CIA was there because they'd be sort of a step away from American law, and
right.
They conduct different things under Native law. But what did the natives get out of it? I mean, why would the Cabazons want this? Were they paid off? I mean, how did that happen?
Yes. Yes, it was a joint powers agreement that benefited the tribe in various ways. Money,
right.
You know, they were a dirt poor, barely surviving tribe.
I understand. So they paid off probably the leadership there, and they then had made a deal. So now go fast forward to Oklahoma City then.
That's right. The earliest stories from the Oklahoma City bombing had information that didn't make it into what is called the real story or the national story.
Yes.
Or the properly understood story.
Understood.
There's a newspaper, I'm going to check its name, in Oklahoma City. It's called the Curtin County Gazette, if I'm not mistaken, and a couple of radio stations had news reports immediately after, where they interviewed firefighters who were coming out of the building. And these reporters saw the firefighters carrying large objects, and they said, "What are those?" Firefighters said, "These are explosives. These are unexploded incendiary devices." Now, what I forgot to mention is that Timothy McVeigh also had a bomb there in his truck, which was parked a good 20 yards away from the Murrah building there on Fifth Street.
Okay.
So the official story is that it was only McVeigh's homemade bomb. But the firefighters coming out said, "Here we have two more explosives." And the reporter says, "Well, tell me more." And the firefighters could not talk. They said, "We've been instructed not to talk about these explosives." Yeah. So the picture is that the massive damage to the Murrah building and up the street for 16 blocks couldn't have been done by McVeigh's bomb alone. And it's on the record that there were other devices, so many of which, that some of them, even though they didn't go off, there were enough others to put out, to light cars on fire and knock out building windows 16 blocks up Fifth Street from the Murrah Building. A policeman that was interviewed by the Curtin County Gazette said, "We've been talked to. I can't discuss this. We've been talked to." Another guy said, "I have a family. We've been threatened." These are public service safety officials talking to the Curtin County Gazette. And this was immediate laughter. Now, in a couple of days, the national story began to be put together and omitted anything about extra explosives, no interviews, nothing. Eventually, the story but the public record shows an interview with, let me get this right here, Charles. A member of the this is a Pentagon study that was leaked. As you know, some government stuff leaks and some doesn't, and this did. On March 20, 1996, which was a year or so after the bombing, a leaked Pentagon study called McVeigh a Fall Guy. The official said, not a mastermind, the official said McVeigh was a useful idiot. So the story in this book here discusses McVeigh as a groomed fall guy.
Okay.
And that's a connection. That's the connection. But Michael Reconosciuto, the CIA asset from the Cabazon Reservation, et cetera, was asked, by this time he was in jail, having been thrown under the bus by the agency. Mm-hmm. They said, "Now, what about this explosive situation at the Murrah Building?" And Reconosciuto said, "Yes, that matches details of what I produced." He called it the Blue Death fuel air explosive that was it was proprietary by then to not exactly the CIA.
So when you say not exactly the CIA, we're talking about and obviously we can't totally know because the CIA is a secret society, but what we're putting together here is that it's a rogue element.
Yes.
In the CIA.
Primarily, the first element that I was to notice was ex-agents, former agents.
Right.
All their contacts.
Yeah, not that any of them can ever be completely former. I mean, when you're in an agency like that,
right,
that's for life. And I mean, I'll give the example, John Brennan, he was the head of the CIA under Obama. Mm-hmm. He and 52 other agents decided to step forward and lie about the Hunter Biden laptop by sending a letter, which was published in the New York Times, claiming that it was Russian disinformation when there was never any evidence of that. And everyone knew this was a lie, including the New York Times, but they needed to do it to stop Trump. And now a year later, the New York Times admits that they had known that this was untrue. But
That was interesting. And like you say, it's for life. And the other main thing is the zeal. Ex-agents that I put in, not exactly, they're zealots. They're passionate men stop operating.
But at what cause? I mean, why would anyone, the CIA or otherwise, want to bomb the Murrah Building with 52 children in a daycare center and do something so heinous? What did they possibly get out of that?
That's a good question. That's of course the main question, and I have the notion that if you look real hard, you will find that to be a great cowboy, ever have been a great cowboy CIA agent, you have to have not only zeal, but ruthlessness, utter ruthlessness.
But at what end? What did they hope to get?
Okay, sorry. You have to be ruthless toward the end of what it is you're zealous about,
which is
the absolute security of the USA against, in that day, it was communism, as you know. And now it's against other real or perceived enemies, such that the deaths of people in terror incidents serves to terrorize the remaining population into a kind of numbness, a passivity, a distrust, a feeling that they're not in control, such that, and I think this is the crux here, such that the public cannot organize, they cannot converse meaningfully toward a grasp and a progressing beyond the situation of being pretty much subjugated in a friendly way by their government. It's what's called friendly fascism, such that you have elections, but you don't have democracy. You don't have power of the people to govern themselves. No, you have elections instead. And to move past that, to gain for popular control of power to be gained, would take organization, which would take time and focused effort by a concentrated, concerted citizenry. And I think that with repeat terror, 1995, 1996, it just keeps it coming and keeps people off balance. I think the idea was to keep people off balance and feeling that they have no real power. They have no idea what's going to happen next. It's a world that they have no control over.
Well, you know, Roger, your explanation is as good as any I've heard, in that terrorism does serve that purpose. It creates such horror, such insecurity, such destruction of order, that people crave some kind of a return to order, and they look to the Great White Knight, which shows up as an authoritarian and establishes order based on their own understanding. And the sacrifice there is democracy, as you say.
Right.
And
security.
That's right, security. So they pick the very center of the United States, Oklahoma City, the kind of the most innocent place you can imagine, and they do this heinous crime. The only thing that I would note as evidence of what you're saying, and again, this is just facts, that came out of the Oklahoma City bombing, was that there was a group in Congress who introduced what was called, quote, anti-terrorism legislation to stop, quote, domestic terrorists. And this group was headed up by a newly elected young New York congressman by the name of Charles Schumer. And it was also backed by Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank. I know this because I interviewed Barney Frank at the time, and he praised this legislation.
Yes.
And what this would have done in the guise of an emergency because of this rise of domestic terrorists was to allow for the government to hold people without trial in secret and try them without them having the opportunity to face their accuser or even the evidence that was brought against them. They could be held indefinitely. They could be held in secret. It basically threw away a large portion of the Constitution. It suspended habeas corpus. It suspended elements of due process, all in the name of combating this alleged rise in domestic terrorism. And I think that some of these same laws, which did go into effect, even though they were controversial at the time, they were further advanced by the events of September the 11th, 2001. And I think that they're playing a role today in the detention of hundreds of people involved in the so-called insurrection at the National Assembly on January 6th. It's basically that they have no rights. They haven't been tried. They're being held without counsel. They're being tortured, you know, and it's all because of this alleged emergency that I think started at Oklahoma City.
It you can say that it started there. You're correct. And I want to say that that is the incentive, if you will, is with the terrorist acts, the incentive was that the legislature would not ignore these acts either. The legislature would feel pressure to enact laws, new, more oppressive, if you will, laws, laws toward absolute security. And they, as you just mentioned, one of them.
That's right. And there has been a further nationalization of our, you know, what I would call the deep state, what Professor Michael Glennon over here at Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy calls the double government.
Go ahead.
I mean, tremendous. I interviewed him. It's a tremendous, he wrote a tremendous book about this. And he's an establishment guy. I mean, he's not some lightweight. That Obama, when he was running for office and speaking in Colorado City Springs, called for a national police agency that would basically replace or supplement local, you know, sheriffs and local police, and that there is this move toward this kind of infrastructure. All of this comes under the guise of response to alleged domestic terrorists.
Yes.
All right, so my guest is Roger Phelps. The book is Not Exactly the CIA, published by Trine Day Books, available at trineday.com and also at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. Not Exactly the CIA, A Revised History of Modern American Disasters. So, Roger, bring us up to the events of September the 11th, 2001.
Lots has been written about that, as you know.
Yes.
I think it's correct to say that the majority of the American public suspects that the official story is wrong. And you have various probes into elements of the official story that really can't be true. It's similar to the OK City bombing in that there had to have been more explosives than were reported.
Right.
So you have the engineers of America pointing out engineering-wise how the damage doesn't equate with the reported amount of explosive. A lot of writing has been done on that. I have focused rather on the money aspect of the situation. As you know, the World Trade Center was home to all kinds of different offices.
Indeed.
Lots of financial offices. I'll just tick them off here. Lots of government offices, including investigative task forces into money laundering and banks, etc. So,
yeah, Chase. I think Chase Manhattan had a major footprint in there, as did Cantor Fitzgerald, which was a major.
That's right. Now, it's been a while since I wrote this, but the gist is that a computer system in a bank, I believe it was Chase, and I can check that if you want. It'd take me a minute or two to check it.
Okay.
If you would like, I would
go right ahead. We'll go. Yeah.
Well. A reporter, an investigator, finally got a hold of a guy who worked at the bank, and he said, right at the explosion, the first explosion, there was a massive shutdown of our computers that lasted for a long time. And these computers were deemed destroyed, but as you know, there's recovery guys who can go into the debris of a computer and find at least some of what was there.
Right.
And these records that were destroyed were of transactions that amounted to money laundering. Now, in the building as well, and destroyed record-wise as well, was a five-agency intergovernmental task force, county, state, and federal, who'd been looking into money laundering very hard for the past several years. These records were all there in the Trade Center, and that was destroyed. So the contents of the human and record contents of the Trade Center were a target for not so much fellas from the Middle East, although there were fellas from the Middle East who were thinking of doing some damage in America. Nobody questions that.
Yeah.
But these fellas appear to have been, and much has been written about this too, they have uncomfortable connections to government. If you look at them one by one, you find out that hotels were paid for and such down in Florida. A flying school was paid for down in Florida for some of these guys. And it gets real uncomfortable there when you look at that.
Well, it does raise questions.
It was a target not only for Middle Eastern fellows, but for Americans who were, I would almost want to say, running in the CIA sense, these Middle Eastern fellows. With the target of the records, the money laundering records, going away.
Well, you know, the first World Trade Center bombing, I think it's been pretty well proven that there was at least FBI agents involved in it. And they seem to run this kind of scam where they, you know, both FBI, CIA, I suppose, where they infiltrate a group. And then at times they actually serve as the ringleaders for the group. And that includes, as you pointed out earlier, both FBI or CIA agents, but as well assets, people who are kind of semi in it or who are like, you know, used by them. It's kind of a murky relationship. I mean, this has everything to do, by the way, not to get into a subject, but with the January 6th incursion in the U.S. Capitol, you had people like the ringleaders, like Ray Epps, never charged, never questioned. And he's been seen on multiple videos that at least were on YouTube, if they haven't been censored, where he's like exhorting people to go into the Capitol the day before the event. Well, I mean, where did he come up with that? And I think that this same tendency exists in these agencies. And sometimes it's necessary. You know, they did infiltrate and basically destroy the Ku Klux Klan, which I think was a conspiracy against the United States. They infiltrated and destroyed the mafia, again, a conspiracy against the United States. So, you know, I'm not against this kind of work if they're doing it for very specific people who, you know, and it's done with some judicial oversight and it's done properly. But the problem is that there is a rogue element that's undermining American groups and, you know, that's undermining patriots and that's getting involved in all kinds of mischief in terms of American life. And I think maybe the motivation, as you said, is to create a more authoritarian system by creating and sowing discord and terror.
There's a guy named Theodore Shackley. As you mentioned, the deep state has been called by many names. Another name is the secret team. Mm-hmm. And a guy named Theodore Shackley, a champion cowboy CIA agent who was fired by Jimmy Carter, is very prominent in what characterizes this loose aggregation. So in Cairo, after the Camp David agreements by Carter governing the Sinai and the conflict between Israel and Egypt, the American influence was very great, and that meant that the CIA was there as a matter of course. Shackley, by that time, no longer worked for the agency, but he and his friends were there in Cairo out of zeal, because that's what they did, was do operations. And they were in, the Sinai was characterized by a lot of opium trade, and the Egyptian security agency, as you might imagine, just had to look the other way some. They took some money from the opium guys. It was just sort of an arrangement. Mm-hmm. It was business as usual. Now comes the Shackley-led band of not exactly the CIA, I guess. They had some dummy companies there. One was a transport company that carried the first batch of arms that Carter sent to aid to aid Egypt in defending mm-hmm. itself against Israel. Sure. So that was why they were there. And with the opium fellas were the ones with the information of what was happening on the ground. So both the CIA itself and Shackley's band were intimate in gaining intel from the opium guys, such that there was too much of an interaction. And as you might imagine, especially since Shackley was private, some money was being made, maybe not much, but just sort of as a, you know, an adjunct. Oh, well, we'll take a little bit, you know, we're protecting these guys.
Right.
And there was a Straight Arrow CIA investigator. Let me get this right. Who was assigned, his government job was to look for crime committed by either military or people with, quote, a nexus to the military.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his job. And in that, he saw that agents who had a nexus to the military were committing some crimes, basically just opium crimes. And it was his job, and he was all set to report it. And he had his plane ticket booked. And he shouldn't have booked it as early as he did, because, well, there's a pause here. It was Arrow Airlines 1285, which was going to New York City, passing over Canada and the town of Gander.
Oh,
in Canada.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Major and it crash. Went down. Many Americans were killed, including CIA Straight Arrow Dirk Miller, who was going to report. So it just is too much of a coincidence to assume that there's no connection, because the CIA at the same time had arrangements with Frankfurt airport personnel. The planes from the Middle East were all going through Frankfurt, and then mostly London, and then to New York City. And the airport personnel were compromised. And this very same situation, the Frankfurt compromised airport personnel, characterizes the Lockerbie crash as well. That went through Frankfurt. It was a Pan Am plane. There are interviews with Pan Am employees describing how they were helping the CIA in combating a heroin distribution system. Both sides of the coin being played, of course. The CIA did work in combating, or at least, you know, monitoring heroin internationally. And they did go to Frankfurt and do business there, getting paid for it and doing their normal job. So that the account that I stumbled across, and which fits the facts, is a bomb being put on at Frankfurt on the plane that went down over Lockerbie by a compromised Frankfurt airport person.
Right.
All the same motivation and characterization as Gander.
So, you know, you had a situation where they decided to take a few select people out, and in the process, they murdered hundreds of innocent people by blowing up an airplane. I mean,
I've got a quote from a guy who used to work with them.
Yeah.
And I'll paraphrase it. He said, the guys I worked with are utterly ruthless. They would take out a 747 full of people to kill one person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, you know, I don't doubt it. I mean, obviously, we're dealing with people who are quite amoral at best, and it reflects. Yes. They reflect a certain establishment point of view, quite frankly, where, you know, the ends justify the means. It's very right. Machiavellian,
right?
And the ultimate goal. I mean, you have to, as Stalin said, you have to crack a few eggs to make an omelet.
Has he said that? Is that from him?
I think so. I mean, well, there was this New York talk about, you know, this New York reporter, New York Times guy, was it named Durante, Walter Durante, who was reporting on Stalin, very praiseworthy, and crack a few eggs to make an omelet. And he was walking across fields with corpses and didn't report any of that. And he got the Pulitzer Prize, which is still on the wall at the New York Times.
Mm.
But it just reflects a certain amoral point of view that I think permeates much of our establishment. It's not, you know, the people, the rogue elements of the intelligence agencies, you know, what you call accurately, not exactly the CIA. They're just the foot soldiers. They're the grundoons, the troops who are doing the bidding of this broader, amorphous coalition, what I call like an
now there. There, I would take issue with you.
Okay.
I think the way I see it is that it's a lateral. You're describing a vertical relation with some instigating, motivated element, so to speak, above, not exactly the CIA. I mm-hmm. see it as more of a lateral relationship. This is a power center it's private. And it's alongside the quasi-public one that you're describing. That's just the way I see it. Not to make a big thing of that.
Okay, so then it's kind of like an informal partnership that it goes way back. You could even trace it back to the days of the formation of the mafia in the 19th century and the secret societies of Europe, like the.
Yes.
You know, the Carabinaras.
Seeking help by partners. You put your finger on a very important element here, that the mafia was always available as a power center if it was needed.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think that there was some reliance on the mafia by the United States to fight World War II, and also the Cuban, Bay of Pigs operation. Yeah. And I think that the establishment was angry at Kennedy for, not going all the way with that, and then trying to maybe work out a deal to normalize relations with Cuba and not go into Vietnam. And so, you know, he ran afoul of this operation, didn't he?
I would say so. So much has been written about the Kennedy assassination that I avoid that one.
Okay.
But I know the stories and I don't disagree with them.
And there's been stuff coming out recently that were declassified. And I'm not that he's the most reliable of people, but I do follow Roger Stone. And he notes that he's a good friend of Trump's. And he said that when Trump authorized the release of classified information about the Kennedy assassination, he didn't release all of it, and because the CIA and the FBI still claimed that to do so would have revealed methods and sources, putting aside the fact that the sources are all long dead, and the methods, that's what's interesting. So Stone asked Trump, why didn't you authorize the release of this stuff? And Trump's answer, according to Stone, was, because you don't want to know what really happened. It's so horrible.
Uh-huh.
Because I think we do want to know what really happened. I don't care how horrible it is. You know, the truth is the best antiseptic, as it were, to get to the bottom of corruption in our society. And there's no reason to keep those things secret, but they still are. I think even Biden is trying to release it, and they still won't do it. Hmm. So there's something, as Shakespeare says, there's something rotten in Denmark.
Now, I want to match that with a quote from Pericles by Shakespeare. Yeah. Hold on one second. All right. This is the general Pericles.
Mm-hmm.
And
the great Greek statesman, right?
Pardon?
He was the great Greek Athenian statesman, I seem to recall.
That's right. I believe he had ex-military. But his line in the play by the name of Pericles is, "Blush not in actions darker than the night. We'll shun no course to keep them from the light." So don't worry about what you're planning to do being darker than the night, because you'll shun no course to keep them from the light, and everything will be hunky-dory.
Mm.
Keep them secrets.
Roger, do you think that it's too late for our society to undo some of this massive intelligence infrastructure that, again, to quote Michael Glennon, that has become a double government that's so embedded in all aspects of our lives? I mean, they've got agents in all of the official part of our government, you know, the Congress, the Supreme Court, but they're also so embedded in the secretive side of things and so interconnected with secret intelligence groups in other countries, like in Britain, France, Israel. Have they reached the point where they cannot be challenged? Is there anything that you and I, you know, John and Jane Q. Public can do?
The society is changing so fast. You know, the rate of change has accelerated.
Yeah.
So that even when I first began research on the book, which was maybe 6 years ago, I might have given you a different answer then, a more optimistic answer. The rate of change and the less likelihood of critical thinking, rational conversation, et cetera, the likelihood of that sort of stuff, which would be a prerequisite to any organization to get either executive or legislative progress going here, mm-hmm. I see that as the chances constantly lessening, basically because of the electronic element in our lives now, where mm-hmm. conversations are all electronic instead of table conversations that would be actual meetings for actual action. It's electronic now. No offense, sir.
No, look, we all love the electronics. I mean, we're all part of this. I mean, I look at the smartphone all day. I'm just like everyone else, and it can be used for both good and bad. But I mean, even now at this point, it's fairly out in the open. For example, at WEF in Davos, which is meeting right now, they're pretty much openly talking about converting the entire world to a digital currency, in which mm-hmm. they'll know every transaction you make, and the interface between big tech and government, which is something that they're openly endorsing and calling for the banning of what they call quote unquote misinformation. It's a complete informal tyranny. I mean, it's a that is enveloping the world. And you know, there's always been this kind of conspiracy. Every generation's dealt with it. As someone who believes religiously, I think it goes back to Adam and Eve and their attempt to overthrow God with the forbidden fruit. But either way, you can look at that metaphorically. Every generation has had this. Every generation has had groups of people who think they know better than everyone else and who seek to overthrow God and rule the world in the sense of creating an earthly empire. And except now they have tools at their disposal that are more lethal than anybody can even imagine, with the artificial intelligence, with and their agenda of transhumanism, and all the rest. And so we're really, you know, up against a conspiracy, and I do use the word conspiracy, that is much more vast and much more integrated than anything we've ever seen before.
The currency aspect is a good point. That's just one more unifying or uniformization of what people need, absolutely have to have in order to carry on their ordinary lives. There has to be participation in this uniform system, which, as you point out, is unfortunately completely controllable by a comparative few. The electronics communication perhaps was just a one step toward that direction. The currency, that would be a big second step. And it might be the same people. But the point I'm trying to make is that once people got used to that, as they have to electronics, as you said, they will still be able to carry on more or less what passes for ordinary lives. They'll be able to go to the store. They'll be able to go to a ball game. They'll be able to have children. And that will be enough. Well, not for me, but I'm different. I think maybe it'd be enough. And so that would be yet another reason for complacence, you know, for just letting it go. As long as I can still have my children and my milk from the store,
right,
all that stuff is extraneous to me.
Yeah, but I think that even you're putting a bit of a rosy picture on it, because if they develop what they're openly calling for, which is a credit score for social behavior, then and they go to an electronic passport, which is something that they openly are calling for, and they almost achieved it under the guise of the pandemic, the so-called pandemic. The only reason they were stopped was because of the brave Canadian truckers. Thank God for Canada. You know, they put, if it wasn't for the Canadian truckers blocking the highway and bringing the world economy to a halt, and that was spreading all over the world. I mean, Australia, New Zealand, France, even Israel, that this corrupt establishment had to turn back. You know, they had to step back because they realized that there were enough people who are awakened to this that they could not pull it off. But they still have those things in place, and that, you know, they still want to achieve this kind of hermetically sealed world. I mean, it's what Aldous Huxley talked about in his book, Brave New World. You've studied the CIA, and I think that it's safe to say that while Bill Donovan, who was one of the founders of the CIA under the OSS, they picked up where the Nazis left off, as did the British Tavistock Institute, as did the Soviet Union, as did Mossad eventually, in terms of experimenting with mass mind control. You know, the Nazis really perfected this as an art and as a science, with their mass rallies and their stimulation of people's minds and emotions. And in the United States, it was exposed in the 70s during the Church Committee hearings as Operation MKUltra. Do you think this is still going on? And do you think that the CIA is still researching how to manipulate the masses by use of psychological techniques?
Well, you mentioned artificial intelligence. So there's a lot of energy going that way. And you might say that that could be a effective substitute for the controlling of human minds. Mm-hmm. You just substitute artificial minds. That's a very broad, rough statement, almost meaningless, what I just said. But it sort of hints at a direction. The MKUltra experiments, they were of a time, and they were viewed as timely is about all I can say. They were viewed as needed. Vietnam was was getting out of control, and people need a certain circle absolutely needed some victory in Vietnam. And so outlandish, outrageous things were done mm-hmm. at that time. I believe it's a different time now, such that to answer your question though, hypnosis as well as drugs was much, much, much studied. Mm-hmm. And I believe that is still in the kit bag.
Yes.
Expert hypnotists can, I think, are still operating. This poor fellow who shot up the Pulse nightclub mm-hmm. in Orlando, Florida, Omar Mateen. There's evidence, if you look closely, that he was under hypnosis, as there was that Tim McVeigh.
As there was Sirhan Sirhan.
That's right. That's yeah. right.
And maybe so, Charles Manson.
Yeah, and that certainly is going to go on. Yeah. I don't know how much more can be perfected, but
well, you're talking here about the creation of human automatons. I mean, which is something that there's a lot of speculation about. I mean, okay. We can't speak about that definitively. That's only suggested, but it is something that is certainly plausible and ought to be understood. And you mentioned the drug aspect. I mean, this was discussed by Aldous Huxley again in his Brave New World and by his cousin, Julian Huxley. And that basically Aldous Huxley talked about a world pharmacological concentration camp where everyone would be happy and punchy and feel good because they'd all be on some kind of a controlled substance. Isn't that what's happening now? I mean, most people are taking something. You know, you see CBD everywhere. I don't know about where you are, but I'm in Boston. Big billboards everywhere, CBD. You can get it. It's in candy. It's in...
Is that cannabis?
Yeah. I mean, it's everywhere. 7-Eleven has it in gum and in candy and in drinks and in...
Now, let me throw one at you. anabolic steroids.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, as you know, there's an opioid epidemic in this country that receives publicity and research.
Right.
There is a much less publicized steroid epidemic, which receives no publicity and very little research. Now, what I'm working on right now, which is not yet published, is an answer to how did we get where we are with all this insanely aggressive behavior? And I happen to include the January 6th insurrection in that, which might not sit well as a topic with you and many of your listeners, but tough. Steroids. Steroids are everywhere. The VA, the Veterans Administration, prescribed, guys got hooked on steroids in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
They just did. And yeah. they came back, and the Veterans Administration prescribed steroids for PTSD, for schizophrenia, and for low back pain, creating an extension of the phenomenon of addiction to steroids. And that's about all I'll say. But in terms of, you say, what everybody's taken something to get by, I think that the use of steroids is right in that.
I agree. Fascinating subject, Roger. Please keep me posted as you do your research. You know, I'd like to have you back to develop that further.
A new book out, Charles.
Please, what is it?
It's called Bitter Heat. And a shorter subtitle than I have for it would be Deliberate Global Warming as a criminal matter, discussed as a criminal matter. It's by Trine Day, and it's out now.
Send me an email on that, and
I will.
We'll come back. CharlesMoskowitz@gmail.com. And
right.
And your book, again, as it is available right now on the Trine Day website and at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, but get it at Trine Day. because they're the publisher and it's a direct thing. You don't have to give the people over at Amazon a cut. Not exactly the CIA, a revised history of modern American disasters. Roger Phelps is my author. Roger, let me just quickly mention, because I have my own sponsorship, which is myself and my books. So I have to mention my latest book is The Populist Wave, The Origin and Rise of American Nationalism and Populism, available.
Yes, you have a phrase connected to that book, the growing informal international aristocracy. I like that phrase.
Thank you. Well, that's what I call it. But so that's in my latest book. So if you want to support my show, check that one out. And Roger, listen, I want to thank you for joining me. Really interesting talk. Let's stay in touch. I want to do an ongoing series with you. I'm on the air Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. So I get time to do it. So anyway, thank you very much for joining me. I shall return, God willing, tomorrow, 3 p.m. Thank you to the good people at TECN-TV. And have a great afternoon, everybody.
Thanks, Charles. Goodbye.
All right, Roger. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.